Yeah, this is something off the focus of the workshop, something completely different, and it's not a magnetar with three buttocks, but I'll put that on the... I'm going to go and do it. Four buttocks, I know. I mean, there's a physical reason why it can't be three. okay, I'm going to give a sort of an obvious gamma ray burst overview, just to sort of give some of the key properties that you all know, but just, you know, what the heck, we'll go through it. And then I'll sort of talk about specific results from shock acceleration theory, mostly stuff that I'm doing with Frank Jones at Goddard, with a Monte Carlo simulation that we've had at our fingertips for a long time. And but the focus, there are quite a few people now working in relativistic shock theory with different accents. So let's see. Here you've seen this all. This is Batsy. I don't know which side to go. Batsy light curve data from early bursts, 1991. The point of showing this is that you just get quite an array of disparate profiles, time histories. Some of these are sharp rise, quasi-exponential K, what we call FREDs, and then others that have all this multiple structure that look very different. So any theory sort of needs to be able to account for these, and of course that's probably largely to do with the complexity of the environment and the driver of the dissipation. Obviously, they look very different from soft gamma repeater time histories. The spectra, the durations, of course, you've seen this bimodal. It's some short, some long gamma ray bursts. The spectra, well, we sort of have this canonical idea of a spectrum, but that's driven largely by the handful, basically between 6 and 11, depending on whether you take spark chamber data from EGRET or TUF data. And that is that we have broadband spectra for gamma ray bursts. And we know that they peak typically in this band, at least that's what we believe. That may be maybe to some extent driven by selection effects, but there's obviously something peculiar going on. They fall off, this is a new plot, so all the power is up here in the gamma rays. And maybe we're just missing some that actually peak down here. We had, Chris was referring to that on Friday lunchtime's discussion. The point is EGRET has a 20-degree field of view. So it's a small field of view, and for bright Batsy gamma ray bursts, it saw as many as you would expect. So there's no reason to believe that these extended quasi-power laws in the EGRET data are not entirely common in gamma ray bursts. And then, so really what that then means that if there's some sort of critical energy here, there is a power law or quasi-power law generated for several decades in energy. And that means that there must be some sort of particle acceleration mechanism going on. It could be attenuated at moderately high energies. We don't know. We don't have data. We're talking about single photon events up here. And so we don't know whether it's really, whether it's a true power law or there might be something folding off. You obviously expect for cosmological gamma ray bursts that there will be a fold off in the glass range just due to interstellar absorption off the infrared background. You also expect that depending on what your parameter is, that there will be absorption internal to the gamma ray burst if the bulk motions are not excessively high. But that, of course, is a diagnostic. GLAST will probe this range very nicely. This is the EGRET bursts. So we're just looking at the extrapolations, the power laws, the actual data of the solid curves. Here's the 940217 burst with the 18 GeV photon sitting out there, just one photon. Who knows whether it's up there or down there? You can't tell. You can't actually really draw a spectrum around here. And the point of showing this is, A, that there are these spectral indices, not only the fluxes around the Batsy range, disparate by an order of a decade and a half to 2 decades in the bright bursts, the so-called bright bursts, i.e. the ones that EGRET detects. That means that some of these are faint for Batsy and bright for Batsy. But their spectral indices are varied. Is that real or is that not? It looks like it's real. There is a range of spectral indices. But it's you have very few photons out here in the upper portions of these power laws. And so one would really like to get much better data. And GLAST, of course, will be able to see gamma ray bursts within its field of view. It has a larger field of view, so it's going to see them more often and with greater sensitivity than EGRET did. The other point...
excuse me, what are typical photon indices?
Okay, this is e to the minus 2 roughly. Well, you can draw it down here. The super bowl burst is roughly e to the minus 2, and some of these, the steepest down here is e to the minus 3 roughly, I think. So, okay, So, oh, ACT. Okay, the next point is that Whipple went and searched, and Hegra did too, and they didn't see anything for gamma ray bursts. At the time I drew this plot, they had not seen anything but had found constraining upper limits, constraining in a sense, because they're non-contemporaneous data. These are obviously bursts before the gas depletion and egret spark chamber. These are 1997 searches, 1996, 1997 was the publication date, I think. And so therefore, they're looking at gamma ray bursts that were not seen, not seen in the egret band. And they didn't see any TEV photons coming from them. And that, of course, predated the so-called Milagrido detection of a gamma ray burst that was a very faint Batsy burst, but if it were, it was somewhere down here. Because it has a similar sensitivity to up here, it would imply either, if it's an extended power law, a very flat spectrum, or it would imply another component coming in. Of course, that data is the significance of the detection is based on how many gamma ray bursts Milagrido / Milagro, since Milagro is now online, looks for. And they're not seeing any more events, so therefore the statistics get degraded and it becomes a less and less significant signal. So they're getting, I think, pessimistic. Of course, Milagro, has a great field of view, almost half the sky, but of course it's and it has a much, in a sense, has a better duty cycle than the other TV experiments. That's why you don't expect to see very often with a conventional atmospheric Cherenkov telescope that's pointed and not a water detector like Milagro. You don't expect to see gamma ray bursts very often, particularly if they're at high redshifts and therefore they're completely absorbed. So, okay, broadband spectrum. This is the show, if you actually put, data points and different bands, X-ray, optical, and radio, so we're really looking at the afterglow here, that you see sort of this structure with spectral breaks. Maybe there's some synchrotron self-absorption, maybe there's cooling going on, there's something going on in the afterglow, and we expect that in the prompt emission too, but the prompt emission is relatively faint. Somewhere I had a plot of that, well, I've got the theoretical plot anyway. So theories have to explain all those spectral structures. The time behavior, as you all know, power law decay in time after the initial prompt flash, gamma ray burst event, and then we've now seen in several now these turnovers at late times after the gamma ray burst in the optical, where it's attributed to change in the dynamics of expansion due to expansion beyond some finite cone as you get spilling out over the edges of the gas. That, in a sense, can be used to probe. If you know, it can sort of provide some constraints on the Lorentz factor, because it's basically when the opening angle of expansion exceeds 1 over the Lorentz factor, either when the Lorentz factor becomes sort of mildly relativistic to some extent. Now we go to the 99.0123 event, which has the although it has the optical flash, a prompt optical transient, as opposed to a sort of continuous decay. In a sense, this was a really nice result to be able to find this, because it's difficult to find, to have your sleuth searchers actually pick up, and that's why it was required. It was detected sort of an afterthought. Actually, ROTCE didn't detect it. They detected it, but they didn't discover it because they were asleep, and. But you need your cameras looking out there in the sky. And the theoretical interpretation of this, I was going to say that Brad Schaefer's been looking for these events for years in the archival sets, and it's sort of hard to come up with them, obviously. And so to actually see this was a real watershed. The theoretical interpretation, largely due to Svi Piran, is that this is the reverse shock. This is actually not any structure, internal shocks or external shocks. But it's the reverse shock that is giving this intense emission. I think that's still highly speculative, particularly as we don't know that a whole lot about reverse shocks in galactic environments. So early, yes. It has to be before it's really hit the set-off phase, because by then the dissipation is dominated by the entire structure and the exterior shell. So the forward shock is what's attributed. What the optical afterglows, and all of the afterglows are attributed to. It's just the forward shock interacting with the external environment. If either that's pre-prepared by the progenitor / companion / whatever your preferred model is, or it's the local interstellar medium, which may be peculiar anyway, depending on what the sites of gamma ray bursts are. So you've all seen this, just sort of like the gamma ray burst, whatever your preferred model, hypernova, if you like coalescence, okay, if you like some hybrid in between, supernovae, whatever. You have a catastrophic event here, it dumps an awful lot of energy in a small volume and have an optically thick variable. It's the mini-universe, mini-early universe. You get freeze out at roughly 10 to the 12 centimeters, and the photons and the pairs sort of decouple, and then propagates out, and what happens from there on in, and that's, it's a supernova. It looks like a supernova, except it's relativistic expansion, just because you've got, you started off with a such a high energy density in a small volume. And that's the key significant difference from a supernova. So just adiabatic expansion gives you, convert thermal energy into kinetic energy, and you get ultra-relativistic speeds. Until it slams into the local environment, and if it's the interstellar medium at standard densities, that occurs in roughly between a few times 10 to the 15 to a few times 10 to the 17 centimeters. And you expect significant or almost total dissipation in that region. You convert your ballistic kinetic energy into randomized energy at relativistic shocks. And that's the sort of canonical scenario which won the Rossi Prize for Rees-Mussels and Paczynski. So I'm really going to be focusing on what happens in that dissipation region. Of course, we've heard from Max and the other alternative scenarios as to what is going on, what is producing the gamma ray burst. We're going to look at what Fermi acceleration can do and what are some of the issues. In spectra, this is from an early paper by Peter and Martin, and I'm showing you all of them because it just shows you can get pretty much anything you like. You get a quasi e to the minus 2 powers new of new spectra with various cutoffs and structures. You get synchrotron self-Compton, and even a third order self-Compton component just by having accelerated particles with some minimum Lorentz factor. And it depends on what your conditions are, your magnetic field, your density of particles, etc. And you can get a whole lot of arrays of them. The key is to sort of see, is there any real reason why some of this structure, one of this structure, appears in the Batsy band? And I think this is a key question that Max raised last week, and it's very hard to actually hone in as to why would there be that peculiar energy scale. Okay, these models, the at the time of that, the spectra, most people thought, they're thinking in terms of external shock as the site responsible for the prompt gamma ray burst emission. The field changed, I guess, about 4 years ago, largely due to a paper by Ed Fanimore and collaborators that said that if you have, if you look at a very smooth shell expanding relativistically, you can't get the complex temporal profiles that you see in lots of gamma ray bursts. You get a rather canonical form called the FRET, the fast rise exponential, the quasi-exponential decay. And that's just a geometrical effect. If you have a sort of like a, if you have just a very smooth shell and it's blasting out relativistically to you, as you see it, you sort of track away. If you have some sort of structure here that you're really causally connected to, say it's interacting with a blob of the interstellar medium, then you get a sort of a sharp rise and a quasi-exponential decay. And it's, you can change that slightly, but the fall off here depends on the height there, and it looks like that. So if you have a whole lot of this, if you have structure and blobs around here, then you should get a superposition of these. And of course, the obviously the time separation, or coupled to the spatial scale, couples to the spatial scale of the interstellar medium. And we don't know that that there is structure on scales smaller than about a hundredth to a tenth of a parsec, although that's observationally limited. It's very hard to observe the structure. Dermer and Mittman, of course, Chuck Dermer is in a sense a pariah in this field because he wants to advocate the external shock model. And that is, this is put out this paper where they say, well, we can produce the temporal structure that's seen in the Batsy data with an external shock model. And whether that's, I mean, they can sort of, whether it's appropriate or not is still, I think, subject to debate. But they did have one valid point, really valid point. And that is, because this is gamma factor moving is of order a few hundred to a thousand, you have this beamed luminosity in your emission region, and it goes as gamma to the fourth. But then your solid angle goes as 1 over gamma squared, in a sense. And as you track away from the line of sight here, you have a huge, because the gamma is so large, you have a huge variation in the flux as you go away from on-axis to off-axis. And what that does is mean that these spikes are a lot sharper and narrower than previously thought for a given size of structure of your interstellar medium. And so that means that sort of gives you, buys you a factor of 100 in parameter space, in other words, the spatial scale, the structure of the interstellar medium. So it's actually possible to resolve, although I think that's probably still difficult.
There's a serious problem actually with the spectrum, because if there's enough gamma flux to significantly reduce the differential gamma between the ambient medium and the fireball by actually pre-accelerating the ambient medium, loading it up with pairs. So
right.
The same problem actually just doesn't work.
Right. There are other reasons for it not working, which I'll get to. So.
There is also, you know, a relative related to this work by Rousseff, who said that if you have a magnetic barrier, you have a non-stationary reflection of interstellar medium particles from the magnetic barrier, you can also reproduce the energetics and the temporal structure, and I'm not sure about the spectrum, but along those lines.
Right. As I remember, Rousseff's work is really is really a hyperplasma simulation in disguise. That's what he did, and the results there that you get out of, it's just like a standard shock, but it's a hyperplasma simulation. I don't know what his boundary conditions were, though, for the magnetic barrier. I don't think anything that I saw in it sort of surprised me and seemed peculiar, and therefore it seemed to be, it would still have the conventional difficulties that any shock, external shock, would have. Right. Yeah, maybe as this I've forgotten who the, he wasn't the lead author. It was Smolsky and Nusov. I thought that they did a hyperplasma simulation, but for the actual physics, I mean,
yeah, it's the they were tracking particles.
Yeah. Okay. The last point is ultra high energy cosmic rays. I mean, obviously that's the gamma ray burst. That's all the stuff. And talking about Rousseff, he was on the paper with Milgram at the same time that Ellie Waxman had a separate paper on, suggesting that gamma bursts were responsible for ultra-high-energy cosmic rays. And this is a 96 version of Ellie Waxman's work, although I don't know if he's fully recanted. He certainly sort of has backed off to some extent. And that you produce, that if gamma bursts have a very high magnetic field, you can generate... you can accelerate particles up to 10 to the 20 electron volts ions, and depending on where your gamma ray bursts are in the universe, you could produce a spectrum with a power law, and then some sort of fold off here as you get into this region where you have photopion production off the cosmic microwave background, and you sort of get cascading, it reprocesses, you get a slight bump, but you explain why there might be a depletion here. Now, this was 1996. We since have a lot of data from the Aquino Agassa collaboration in Japan, on top of the older high-res data, and we have a lot more events up here, 13 above 10 to the 20 electron volts. And what this means is that we've got much better statistics, and it's led to this problem, in quotes, of that there's an evasion of the so-called Grayson-Zacepan-Kuzmin cutoff that we do, which is you expect this to fall off rapidly just because of the presence of the cosmic microwave background, if the sources are more distant than 30 to 60 megaparsecs on average. Gamma ray bursts are, we believe. And so the question is, can you have construct a model with gamma ray bursts where you could actually populate this at the right level? And it's getting increasingly difficult. Just because we have more cosmic rays and because gamma ray bursts, the mean redshift just seems to be getting a little higher, or has, you know, since about 5 years ago. It seems to, there's a recent paper by Floyd Stecker and Sean Scully that the calculation is fairly careful, and I think that sort of rules out gamma ray bursts as a source, because basically you can't produce them often enough within this sphere of influence where you can evade the GZK cutoff.
Is there also a problem with the shape of the spectrum, because you get pile up just below the GZK?
Well, that depends. Yes, you get some pile up, but that gets smeared out depending on how your distribution of your sources. So it's not really, if you get discrete sources, and if you suppose you get angular, you have good localization of where they come from, and there's not too much magnetic diffusion. Spread of the origin, the point of origin, you know, it's diffusing out like 10 degrees or maybe 5. It depends on your angular resolution. At the moment, we can't probe this. With Pierre Auger, we probably will be able to do that. Then you would not, you would have great difficulty. You could perhaps resolve these discrete sources and see structure like that. Otherwise, it just gets smeared out and sort of like gives you some flattening and some steepening because you get the attenuation. So, I mean, there's some effect of that down here at the lower energies here. It's just a convolution. Okay, so that's sort of the background. The reason we wanted to work on this, A, is because it's sexy at the moment, and B, because we had a tool that we had to dust off. This tool is the Monte Carlo technique. I mean, I've been using it frequently in galactic applications, the supernova remnants, from the point of view of theory, it's just itself, and in the heliosphere. So it was natural to, it was first developed nearly 20 years ago by Don Ellison and Frank Jones, and I got involved in it about 9 years ago, and I wanted to apply it to gamma ray bursts and AGNs, just use the relativistic version. It's had relativistic code for a long time, published for over 10 years ago, but nothing's been done with it since, and everybody else is getting into the game. Okay, what does the Monte Carlo simulation do? There are various things you can do, but our code is like, let's look at particles. They diffuse in the shock environment, and they scatter. They scatter off something which we specify a phenomenological mean free path, that the mean free path is proportional to some power of the momentum. This is physically motivated. It's also motivated by simulations and actually observational data at the Earth's bow shock. And we just say, this is what happens to the particles. The particles gyrate, and they scatter, and then they have their momentum is kicked in some direction by some amount, some angle, and they scatter as often as is prescribed by this formula. And this sets up an automatic, you have diffusion in your plasma. The scattering centers are believed to be magnetic irregularities, some sort of resonant, gyroresonant interaction is responsible for them, and if you have a shock, then you have the possibility of both first-order and second-order Fermi acceleration. We focus on first-order because it has certain clean properties, but second-order can be modeled too. So what I've got here, this is the particle trajectories. Here we have time on this axis, number of scatterings, and we have position in space. Here's the shock. We start particles, negative position, that's upstream of the shock, which is, for a gamma ray burst, is say, if you're looking at the external shock, is outside, is in the interstellar medium. And the particle bashes around, scatters off there, and then interacts with a shock. When it interacts with a shock, it's encountering a fluid of differing speed. And so if it scatters off that fluid, or magnetic irregularities anchored in that fluid, then it's like seeing a brick wall coming at it fast. And so on average, when it bounces off that brick wall, it will get a gain in velocity. And so as you get lots and lots of encounters, as it goes back and forth between converging fluid flows, you get an increase in momentum, which is represented by these lines getting longer and longer, i.e. larger spatial diffusion scales. And eventually it escapes downstream of the system. And I actually show here the velocity in the local fluid frame as a function of time in this particular simulation event. This was a non-relativistic shot. But that's, in a sense, the fact that you get a quasi-monoenergetic increase depends on what frame of reference you're looking at. But here in the fluid frame, you get this non-energetic increase in energy is a function of the number of shock encounters, is the principle of the first order Fermi acceleration.
There is no pitch angle dependence on the scattering.
That depends. In that particular run, there was not. In the runs later today, later in this talk, I'm going to show you pitch angle diffusion, which has pitch angle dependence in it. So those particular runs are the simplest construct, which works fine for non-relativistic shocks, and that is that you scatter and you randomly select your pitch angles from a sphere, an isotropic distribution. So
the distribution that you're scattering off of is placed down a priori.
The distribution of
magnetic
yes. The answer is, the answer to that question is that we inherently believe that the magnetic field turbulence is generated by the accelerated particles. So it is influenced. but in a sense you generate a self-similar solution. In a sense, there's a scale-independent solution that, the fusion length is a function of momentum, has no scale. The reason for perhaps believing that is that we see that, we can't determine it, we don't have a broad dynamic range, but in the Earth's bow shock, we see that there is a momentum dependence, the order of two-thirds, the index is two-thirds in the Earth's bow shock for particles diffusing around. People who've done hybrid plasma simulations come out with roughly the same result. If you go up to high enough momentum, you expect that you cannot, the absolute lower bound to a diffusion length is the gyre radius of the particle, and that's proportion of momentum. And you're stuck with that. That's a fundamental physical limit. So you can have very inefficient, you have large-scale diffusion with very weak dependence on momentum. But if you get into these strong shocks with large dynamic scales, you eventually expect to hit at high momentum this wall where the momentum, the Mitre path scales of the gyre radius. There's nothing you can do about that. Okay, talking about the Earth's bow shock. We should run through just a couple of, some heliospheric results where we've tested the Monte Carlo code in its non-relativistic form. And I mean, it's important to do this because we can't do any in-situ testing. We don't have particle measurements in anything outside the heliosphere. And this is the Earth bow shock data taken in the 80s with the Ampli experiment. And we have three snapshots in time. I wasn't on this paper, predates my involvement with this. And the point was that the Monte Carlo took parameters that were appropriate to this particular distribution here, which is the hydrogen distribution upstream of the Earth's bow shock. It's narrow, and when you go downstream of the Earth's bow shock, you get shock heating, and the distribution, the thermal portion of the distribution gets broadened. And it took these parameters and then ran it through the simulation and made a prediction for both the upstream and downstream distributions. The particular scenario here is a situation where what we call a nonlinear shock acceleration as opposed to linear or test particle shock acceleration. That is when there's so much energy density in accelerated particles that they modify the shock dynamics. This is sort of the point that was coming out in the meeting associated with Pat Slane's talk. Is that what happens there is that you have to make a different, your predictions for the relative heating between upstream and downstream change. You're reapportioning your energy from thermal particles up to non-thermal particles. And you've got to do that in a self-consistent way, and the Monte Carlo is very nicely designed to be able to handle this particular problem. What it found here was that in order to get a good fit between upstream data and downstream data for the hydrogen, you had to absolutely have nonlinear shock acceleration effects. And that is that you use these particle distributions to determine the Rankine-Hugoniot conditions. The shock, the compression ratio, the ratio of velocities upstream and downstream, and at different distances from the actual shock discontinuity. So you couldn't do it with a test particle. You just said that these a scenario where these particles were dynamically insignificant. They're just too far up here. What was also present in this was different species, helium, and this CNO mix, which they can never discriminate observationally. They know they don't have great mass discrimination. And these experiments. What they found is, in a sense, that the simulation can produce results for these. It produces the right spectral shape. The normalization is a bit of an artifice because it was put in by hand in the simulation results. In other words, the relative abundance was assumed at a level in order to match the data. And there's no thermal data. The reason that had to be done was there was no data at thermal energies in the helium and the CNO ions. So you're sort of stuck with that. That situation differed in the work that I did recently with Keith Ogilvie on interplanetary shocks, where we had Ulysses data, a much more sophisticated experiment, and this is the solar wind ion composition spectrometer, and where you could actually get a measurement of the upstream spectrum of both hydrogen and helium. These spectra I'm showing you are the downstream distributions. So what we actually had is we had the temperature of both hydrogen and helium. We had the relative abundance of helium. We had very positive, definite measurement of helium in the upstream region. We had the interstellar electron density, interplanetary electron density. We had all these parameters that affect what your shock compression ratio should be. And so we threw all these observationally determined parameters in, And we varied one particular parameter. It's a highly oblique shock that I'm showing you here. This is a really great fit. The one parameter we varied was the ratio of the mean free path to the gyro radius. We chose this to be a constant ratio independent of momentum, and that and that's our only free parameter in this model. And it comes out with this very nice fit. It wouldn't come out with this very nice fit if this were very much larger. It would drop down very dramatically here. The acceleration process is very sensitive to this parameter. We'll hopefully come back to that a little later. The nice thing is that it was able to fit both hydrogen and helium, except for this superthermal region. That's where the problems are, and that's probably where the plasma dissipation processes are most significant. And that's where a simple kinematic type model that we've got doesn't work. Okay, now we need to move on to the relativistic shocks. Okay, so non-relativistic shocks, what are the characteristics? The characteristics are that as soon as you get well above the only energy scale in the problem, i.e. the thermal energies, the particles are isotropic. Down at thermal energies, they're not. It's just, you know, Galilean transformations. You have significant anisotropies. So, but the highest energy particles are isotropic. That's where we invoke the so-called diffusion approximation. It's very simple, and it leads to, you can generate lots of nice analytic results that are not afforded in the relativistic regime. Delta E over E, delta E being the mean energy gain change in a cycle, going from upstream to downstream and back up to stream, divided by the fractional mean energy gain, so delta E over the energy of a given particle is of order 1. So you don't get very much change. But you have lots of cycles, because the speed of the particles are usually, you see when this happens, it doesn't have to be, and then the shock flow is much less than C. So the particle the probability of escape of particles from the system downstream of the shock is very small. It goes as the shock speed divided by the particle speed. So the loss rates are low. And the reason this has been so popular in astrophysics and in cosmic ray physics is that you've got this canonical spectral index that depended only on the compression ratio. R is the ratio of the upstream flow speed to the downstream flow speed. And then this number comes out for compression ratios of 4, typical of strong non-relativistic shocks. This comes out as 2, which is roughly what we see, you know, in astrophysics. So you only had one parameter. Now, is that real? Where this applies really is to strong shocks that have relatively weak magnetic fields, i.e. high alphanic Mach numbers. And therefore, all you're doing is sampling particles traveling, diffusing back and forth across here. When the alphanic Mach number becomes relatively low, i.e. that the magnetic field is dynamically important, the particles get this second order component where on each side of the shock, they're diffusing the relative velocities of the alphane waves is very significant. And that leads to so-called second-order Fermi acceleration. Now, second-order Fermi acceleration is a viable acceleration mechanism. It's just as fast as first-order Fermi because it's basically the gyro frequency is determining the time scale. But it can't produce a canonical spectral index. It can produce basically any spectral index you want because you've got an energy gain as you diffuse around, but you don't know what your loss time scale is. And that varies according to the parameters you put in for your model. So you can get spectral indices all over the place. And so that's, in a sense, not as nice, but it's certainly something that goes on and is believed to be in solar flares as one of the key effects there. Relativistic shocks, no longer do you have isotropy. You don't have isotropy at any speed. And the reason for this is because the flow speed is near C. So the particles are never going that much faster than the speed. So you get these strong beam distributions. Your delta E over E gets larger. It gets 2 if it's in the limit of pitch angle diffusion, which I'll define. It can get much larger. It can go up to around about gamma squared if you're looking at large angle scattering. Although that's probably not the operating scenario. The loss rates are high because you get large energy gains. If the loss rates aren't high, you're going to get a very flat spectral index. And the spectral index is now no longer just a function of the compression ratio. It's a function of the Lorentz factor of the shock. So let's go to old results published in 1990 by Ellison, Jones, and Reynolds. This was done with large angle scattering, i.e. each time you scatter, you sample a momentum vector randomly on 4 pi star radians on a sphere. A non-relativistic shock, this is log of energy, and since there's the acceleration process is scale independent in momentum, you get this structure, you get this bending around if the momentum becomes Marley relativistic or non-relativistic. So you get the power law up here in the for ultra-relativistic speeds. The solid curve here, this histogram is the Monte Carlo result. The solid curve is an analytic result that you can get out of the diffusion approximation. If you then extend that analytic result up to relativistic speeds, you find huge discrepancies. You find that the spectra deviate from it and become very much flatter for large angle scattering. You also find this very large, very significant structure, spectral structure. That is kinematic structure. That is, any time you have a kinematic scattering like that over full pulsed irradiance, you have a range between 1 and gamma squared at which you can sample each time you cross the shock. And that means that you get images of your principal scale, i.e. your thermal particles, and they get replicated as you go to higher energies. We can show you perhaps a cleaner result on that, I mean a cleaner version of that. But I trotted out roughly the same parameters for the shock, and that is we have a narrow thermal peak, and then you get this spectrum of structure like that. This is a kinematic image. It's very much similar to the type of kinematic you get a flat spectrum, a flat distribution, where basically you're sampling different angles as you go back and forth in energy. There's a one-to-one correlation between angle or pitch angle cosine and the energy. And that type of effect is seen in, I mean, that's a very common kinematic effect. I mean, for example, in pi zero decay calculations, anything where you assume that you have this randomization of directions, isotropic emission in one frame when you boost it, you get this kinematic spread. What happens then is, so obviously this doesn't look like anything we see. So this doesn't look like it's going on. When you go and then you take, so what we've done here is I said, okay, this thermal peak is produced by one shock crossing. The particles just start from the upstream region, they cross the shock, they produce a spectrum looking like that. Then they bounce back and forth and cross the shock a couple more times, and after three shock crossings, they produce this continuum. After five shock crossings, they produce this. After seven, they produce that. And it slowly merges into a power law, which is roughly e to the minus 1.5, extremely flat. The reason it's flat is because the energy gains are so large. The energy gain is roughly of order gamma squared. That's, you know, in a shock cycle between three, five, and seven crossings. That's roughly gamma squared. It's not exactly gamma squared. People have been, the reason this gamma squared, you of course realize, has been thrown around in models ad nauseum. And it's not exactly gamma squared because the probability of loss from the system changes. Here, it's relatively small, and it starts to get higher and higher, and you get this convolution where this spectrum is feeding off that spectrum, but with losses, and it slowly steepens in into the scale-independent solution when you get up to high enough momentum so that you have no image, no memory of that particular energy scale. Of course, what was that? That was a 10 to the 6 keV, a GeV for protons, and we're now at 10 to the 12 keV. We're actually up at the Gleason cutoff here. We haven't reached an asymptotic solution. This was a Lorentz factor of 5. You choose a Lorentz factor of 1,000 for a gamma ray burst, it's up there very rapidly in terms of the structure. So you would expect to see huge, if the acceleration were large angle scattering, you would expect to see huge structure with very flat plateaus appearing in the data. And that doesn't seem to be evident, or at least we don't seem to believe it's there. So maybe something else is happening. Maybe it's pitch angle diffusion. Now this is, pitch angle diffusion is another, in a sense, idealized limit of scattering in magnetic field turbulence. And that is that instead of isotropizing your momentum vector, you make it very small changes in pitch angle. Just the angle just changes very slowly in little increments. The large angle scattering is motivated by having very large field turbulence. And we do see quite large field turbulence, delta B over B of order 20% in the interplanetary shocks. And we believe on theoretical grounds that it's probably generated. So large angle scattering might be a very apt descriptor in systems. Pitch angle diffusion is the mathematical limit for small angles. That may also be realizable. Or the scattering may be a combination of the two. Let's have a look at the results. Pitch angle, of course, diffusion can be described by a diffusion coefficient in a very simple formalism, and you can trot out equations and analytic results fairly quickly with that. You can actually do it for large angle scattering too, but that seems to be rarer in the literature. Pitch angle diffusion produces a very different spectrum and very different results. You have a look at the spectrum, it's e to the minus 2.2, much steeper than large angle scattering, And the reason for this is that the energy gain per site shock crossing cycle is of order unity. Here I've done the same thing. We go from one shock crossing, three shock crossings, five shock crossings, seven shock crossings. Roughly the first cycle, you get a Lorentz factor, a gamma 1 increase, and then it saturates into roughly a factor of 2. And then it just goes on. So you don't get much, you get this continuing, roughly a factor of 2 in energy gain per cycle. And the reason for that, so pitch angle diffusion is very different. And the reason for this is that, I'll have to lower that down, is that we have a shock. Here's our shock interface. We have an ultra-relativistic or ultra-relativistic flow, gamma 1 with a speed beta 1 units of C, going into a mildly relativistic flow. Particles are transported across the shock. Once they diffuse around here, in order to get back to the shock rather than escape from the system, they have to have a mildly relativistic speed for order 1/3. They have to have B cosine theta, where theta is the angle to the shock normal, greater than equal to 1/3. And there I've used the ultra-relativistic equation of state, that the product of these, that this speed is 1 and beta 2 is approximately 1/3. So this is a relatively small range of angles. You can then put this into the relativistic Lorentz transformation momentum formula, or Lorentz factor, and you end up with a range of, once the particle gets back here, what is its Lorentz factors, the range of Lorentz factors in the upstream fluid frame, which is sort of, in a sense, that's the energy gain it's got. And then it scatters. And then the particle, when it scatters, because if it's large angle scattering, you isotropize its Lorentz factor, its angle, and then it's just this beam that is blasted down ultra-relativistically at you. In pitch angle diffusion, it's completely different. Pitch angle diffusion, because you're mathematically going from a case where you're aligned, anti-aligned with the shock normal, heading upstream, and you make increments, you increase your pitch angle to the point at which the velocity vector is now, the particle is now heading downstream, and then you basically swept by the fluid flow downstream of the shock. And this is a small angle. For ultra-relativistic, this angle is the 1 minus cosine theta of this angle is 1 over 2 gamma squared, an obvious result. So basically, pitch angle diffusion says that you have this Lorentz cone of relevance in the upstream region. Beyond this this Lorentz cone, particles do not exist in the upstream region. They just get swept downstream. But they don't really exist very long. So if you set that in there, this is the angle, and then you can write down what the new Lorentz factor is in the downstream shock frame as a function of these particles. And then you can compare these two. You come out low with, you can go through that. I shouldn't really be doing this here. But the gamma prime over gamma is of order 2. And it's all because we have this very narrow Lorentz cone. And that's the distinct property of pitch angle diffusion. And that is that you get these large, that you get very small gains, modest gains, as opposed to gamma squares. And that's probably what will be happening in gamma ray bursts. Maybe, maybe not. Our simulation is ideally situated to, designed to treat both large angle scattering, ideal pitch angle diffusion, and something in between. We basically can scatter on any solid, any conical sector of a sphere. And we do so, and here's the results. You can sort of get to see this, the large angle scattering result. You have the pitch angle diffusion here, which for this Lorentz factor of 5 only happens to be about 14 degrees. That's quite a large angle in order to achieve that. And then if you increase this to, a solid angle of order 1, steradian, you actually have this flattening of the spectrum without significant spectral structure, I add. So, but you get a difference. So what you find is that the pitch angle diffusion result, e to the minus 2.2, is a lower bound, is an upper bound of the spectral index. And probably nature will provide something in between this and this. And the reason for that is the magnetic field turbulence. In order to go from pitch angle diffusion to large angle scattering, you need the magnetic field turbulence needs to just kick you out of that Lorentz cone very efficiently in one kick. And that doesn't require, that's not a strong constraint for a gamma ray burst Lorentz factor if it happens to be 10, 100 to 1,000. The magnetic field turbulence doesn't have to be great to be able to kick it out very quickly before it's gyrated. So it's very possible that there is some mix. The definition of large angle scattering is no longer 4 pi steradians, but rather just anything sampling a solid angle greater than 1 over gamma squared. Okay, simulation results. Bednarz and Ostrovsky are the first to sort of really get into this field in recent times. And they have a simulation, Monte Carlo simulation, which has distinct differences from ours, and in fact unresolvable differences. We've not been able to resolve them, and have not in the past. Ostrovsky's been working on this for about 15 years. The particular cases they've got here is Lorentz factor of the shock on here, and here's the spectral index here. And up here is, they derived this result that is now quoted in the gamma ray burst community, the asymptotic result of 2.23, or 2.2 roughly. And they got this result for a plane parallel shock where the field obliquity to the shock, the field obliquity to the shock normal was 0 degrees. They also got it as an asymptotic regime for highly oblique shocks. These are the shock obliquities. 90 degrees means the field is aligned with the shock plane. And eventually, if you went to higher enough Lorentz factors, you got this asymptotic result. That is intuitively obvious in the sense that you should get the results of a highly oblique shock and a plane parallel shock become immaterial when you come to very high Lorentz factors. The results are very sensitive to the field obliquity because you've specified this parameter which couples to the field turbulence, perpendicular and parallel to the mean. It's basically the mean diffusion coefficients perpendicular and parallel to the field. And that's a finer point that I don't really want to get into. We could discuss question time. But you should get basically a perpendicular shock should look like a parallel shock when the Lorentz factor gets high enough so that the Lorentz cone is such a small angle that you don't really care about the nature of the field turbulence. The asymptotic result is an important result for pitch angle diffusion. All these runs are for pitch angle diffusion. They get this wide range. The thing that's disturbing is that they actually get that the spectral index is increasing as you approach this for plane parallel shock. We get the opposite, and the analytic results of Kirk and Schneider get the same thing we do. And need I say, we agree exactly with the analytic work of Kirk and Schneider, as we'll see. Okay, spectral indices for pitch angle diffusion. I'm not going to focus on large angle scattering because, as you saw, we get very large, very prominent structure that completely screws up your spectral index determination and looks opposite to anything. It's not smooth, so we don't see that in the data. This is the column. I'm sorry I didn't plot this out, but you know, the sun was shining and I had better things to do. But here we have Lorentz factor down here, or actually it's effectively Lorentz factor, but it's the gamma times the flow speed. So it's therefore mildly relativistic, ultra relativistic, non-relativistic. Here if we assume an ultra relativistic equation of state, we have a compression ratio of 3. And for those, we specify this in our simulation and we get these results. You basically get the spectral index is getting smaller and smaller and then asymptotically approaches 2.23. And that's to within 1%. That's as accurate as we can do without beating our heads against the wall. So you get this asymptotic result. We're able to reproduce it numerically from our simulations. And it was shown earlier this year. It's on AstroPH. It's published now. John Kirk was the lead author on the paper where they dug up their old analytic convection diffusion equation technique that he had worked with Kurt Schneider, with Peter Schneider 13 years ago. And they revamped it, worked it to get the ultra-relativistic limit and found that it was 2.23, plus or minus 1%, is the asymptotic result, that you actually go to the spectral index for a compression ratio of 3. I've done an array of parameter space here. The reason for doing that is not so much that you can ever physically access this, because this is the relativistic equations of state will force you away from such small or large compression ratios, but you do expect this sort of fanning out from here, that you would be able to sample some of these, depending on what you put in for your magnetic field, your particle density, your temperatures, and things like that, that you can actually, even at a Lorentz factor of roughly 3, you can deviate significantly from a compression ratio of 3. The important point to make is that you get, for any given compression ratio, as the shock becomes relativistic, you get a flattening of the spectrum, i.e. the spectral index gets slower, but it always approaches an asymptotic limit. Okay, we'll leave that for the moment, the gamma squared. Okay, since we're running out of time, I want to do the upstream spectral shapes. Okay, so do we believe our results? And the answer is yes. you obviously go and compare with other, what other people have done. Bednarz and Ostrowski, the spectral index is one check. There is a more solid check is the angular distribution, because the angular distribution is really probing the complete diffusion. And you tend to smear out any structural deviations in the spectral index, but you might end up systematically low or systematically high in a simulation. But you obviously want to get the spectral index right and the angular distribution. Bednarz and Ostrowski get these results. These are done in three different frames. This is the upstream fluid frame, this is the downstream fluid frame, and this is the shock frame. And it's worth showing these because you get this sort of like, in their simulations, you get these structured peak and then a fall off. In the shock frame, you do a transformation to the downstream frame. That's a Marley-Rosenfeld transformation, so it sort of looks roughly the same. These are for different Lorentz factors. In the upstream fluid frame, this distribution is not, it's not very beamed. It's beamed, but it's not like bunched up. In the upstream fluid frame, it's completely bunched up because you've got this relativistic beam coming at you. But the relativistic beam is not, as seen in the downstream fluid frame or the shock frame, it's seen in the upstream frame. And that is because the upstream and the downstream regions talk to each other. You might expect that, oh, the acceleration should produce this highly anisotropic beam in the downstream region. But if it did produce that, then the particles would all escape. They'd never return to the shock. So nature, if in order to have the acceleration process, those are selected out. You have to have, in a pitch angle diffusion scenario, you have to have a situation where in the shock frame, the shock rest frame, the distribution is relatively broad. It's not narrow. That is a physical constraint to any solution you have. This satisfies that. My problem is that it's not the right shape here. The upstream frame, of course, if you just get this beam. This is 1 over gamma. Its width is 1 over gamma, which for 27 is very narrow. It's just a little spike. So the reason, while I was disturbed, this simulation, Bednarz and Ostrowski's simulation is just intrinsically different. The way they do things, like they inject particles at the shock, whereas we inject them far upstream, which mimics what nature does in real systems. And you get very worried about biases being introduced if you inject at the shock. But that's, technical details. At Monte Carlo is this histogram here, and then taking those data points I showed you from Bednarz and Ostrowski, you see that they get this really peak. It's a log scale here, so the peaks don't look that prominent, but these differences are very distinct. And they underproduce in this upstream wing. And that just makes one very nervous. So the answer is, that's one set of, that's simulational data. Years ago when Ellison, Jones and Reynolds looked at the pitch angle diffusion, as well as large angle scattering and relativistic shocks, they checked with Kurt and Schneider, and they produced the identical spectral indices. They didn't produce angular distributions. I'm not sure why they didn't, but anyway, since it's such a good check. So I then picked up the angular distributions that Kurt and Schneider generated for two different speeds, and you come out with perfect agreement. I have to take an energy range, bin in energy because it's a simulation. That's how we do our data collection, if you like. For a shock speed of 0.3 and 0.9C, different compression ratios they chose for their solution, so we matched over. We were able to reproduce the angular distribution exactly. And I mean, this is a linear scale. It's a log scale, but it's very impressive on linear scale. Since they've done their new analytic work, they actually have. They've redone Kirk and Schneider with much higher shock speeds. And what they find is that the angular distribution saturates and becomes asymptotically like this dotted curve. They can produce the dotted curve sort of gets smeared as get moved to the left as your speed drops off. And this is only one particular run, but we're able to match at any particular speed with our histogram. As long as we get high enough statistics, we can match the analytic curves exactly. And you see, again, this peak, this broad distribution, it's not spiked. Relativistically. So we have great confidence in our simulations. So I'm getting close to the end. So I'm going to skip some idiosyncrasies of angular distributions and go to acceleration times before I do a summation. Now the acceleration time is important to the maximum energy you get. So if you're looking at ultra high energy cosmic rays, people do various things with acceleration times. In pitch angle diffusion, you get these nice clean results that the acceleration time, here we have for curves, as a function of energy, we have the acceleration time for a magnetic field of 1 Gauss. And here we have the basically a 0.1C shock, a spot shock that's traveling Lorentz factor of roughly 1, and then a Lorentz factor of 10. We're going up in increments of 3 of this product gamma times beta. And what you see is this sort of like this monotonic decrease that asymptotically approaches a limit, and it should. It does. If you plot gamma 1 and beta 1 equals 30, it just virtually overlays this gamma 1, beta 1 equals 10. And because you get this asymptotic solution for the spectral index, you get a limit, and you get an angular distribution that's asymptotically fixed. In other words, that there is no variation, there's no relativistic compression of it, and you have to have that because you've got the same speed in the downstream fluid, then you should get the acceleration time saturates at some value. It turns out to be less than the value you would compute from the non-relativistic acceleration formula that comes out of the diffusion equation for non-relativistic shock acceleration theory, which is assuming isotropy. So the anisotropic effects in an ultra-relativistic shock give you this roughly an enhancement, a decrease in acceleration time by a factor of 4 relative to that. If you draw this curve, it would lie over here, up here, for a speed. If you were to increase it, basically the non-relativistic formula decreases 1 over beta squared. So if you adjust for the beta, you lie right over that. The upstream, that's the total acceleration time. The upstream acceleration time gets extremely short. And it goes from basically half the total acceleration time at non-relativistic speeds, but it keeps on going down. And it goes down as 1 over gamma squared. Surprise, surprise. The upstream acceleration time is just the time it takes to get out of the Lorentz cone. And the Lorentz cone is opening angle is of order 1 over gamma. And you just think if you're diffusing on a sphere, or diffusing in a sphere in 2 dimensions, you should get that your acceleration time drops as 1 over gamma squared. And that's precisely what we get. And so the upstream acceleration time is irrelevant to the problem. All you care about is what's going on downstream. All these acceleration times were measured in the shock frame. Well, it turns out that Lorentz transformation properties are very nice. And I'll spare you the derivation. We'll just go down to the bottom line. But if you go through, pick out your stuff from Jackson, standard equations, and then compute acceleration times in any given frame, where you're just having clicks where particles scatter, and they scatter in their local fluid frame, then the time in, say, a given frame of reference, delta in the shock frame, is proportional to the time in the fluid frame, which is just that intrinsic diffusion time scale, times this ratio of Lorentz factors. If you pull this over here, down to the bottom there, then you find out that delta T over gamma is an invariant, which of course is the proper time of scattering in the particle's frame itself. So given that, that enables you to compute the acceleration time in any given frame of reference. And what it says is the acceleration time is only really a property of the Lorentz factor of the particle in the particular frame you're looking at. That's what you measure. So therefore, when you go and look at total acceleration times, you say, this is what it was in the shock frame. Then you'd say, well, okay, if I want to measure a particle of a particular energy up here and see what its acceleration time is in the fluid frame, it might be in a different stage of its evolution when it reaches that momentum, but it will have this roughly the same acceleration time. It's not exactly the same, and that's there's an anisotropy factor in there. It's of order unity. And that's to do with the probability of the particles being detected in a given energy. Okay, I think I need to move on to the closing transparency, the key questions for the gamma ray burst shock connection. The reason I emphasize that is because people invoke Lorentz factors all over the place in models of gamma ray bursts and throw out Lorentz factors and say, oh yes, we get this gain in Lorentz factor, or this gain because of the Lorentz factor. And you've got to be very careful in what you do. Okay, the key questions is a summation. What is the shock gamma? Well, we don't know that. Now, I've sort of talked about a survey parameter space so that we can encompass both external shocks and internal shocks. If it's an external shock, it might be 10 to the 3. If it's an internal shock, it would be mildly relativistic. So it depends on whether you're looking at the afterglow or the prompt event. The trying to probe this is probably best done through the temporal considerations of the afterglow or spectral considerations of the gamma rays, looking for gamma-gamma pair creation turnovers. But there is some information, and that is that comes from the spectrum itself. And that is, I showed you those spectral indices, and if pitch angle diffusion truly operates, then you have basically, with a given spectrum, you have a spectral index that's a lower bound to the spectrum you can get for a given compression ratio. And if you're looking at ultra-relativistic shocks, i.e. an external shock, you expect that the spectrum is going to be flatter than e to the minus 2.2. So if GLAST comes up with spectra that are considerably steeper than that, in a lot of cases, that's telling us something. It's telling us that an ultra-relativistic shock is not involved. And that is then telling us that it's very probably a lower Lorentz factor that we're looking towards internal shocks. The magnetic field, internal versus external shocks, huge difference. An external shock, it's going to be, in the afterglow, it's going to be a microgauss, maybe up to a milligauss, because that's typically what we see in the stellar environment, prepared or unprepared. Internal shocks, it can be as high as you like, in a sense. Equipartition, sub-equipartition, it could also be as small as you like, but nobody likes it small. Is pitch angle diffusion or large angle scattering or a mixture operating? I tend to think that there's a mixture operating, that it's fairly close to the pitch angle diffusion, but it has some component of large angle scattering just because we expect significant turbulence to be operating in a field in a shocked environment, and it doesn't have to be too significant in order to get deviations from the pitch angle diffusion results. I've talked about the energy gains per shock crossing. If you're looking at ultra-high energy cosmic rays, you might be able to say, okay, well, if we have large angle scattering, we can get large gamma squared amplifications, but that doesn't actually buy you anything. The acceleration times are only modestly shorter for large angle scattering than they are for pitch angle diffusion. I didn't show you that. So you don't really accelerate things. You can get them. It's basically you have to consider the losses and how much the particles diffuse and what their angular distributions are at any given time. And it's sort of a very complicated problem, but with a simulation you can probe this very accurately. What is the iron injection efficiency? I haven't addressed that. We have significant iron injection efficiencies in our simulation. With e to the minus 2.2 spectra, that is steep enough that the nonlinear acceleration effects are very small, that the, most of the energy is in the quasi-thermal ions rather than in the other highest energy ions. The electron injection efficiency, who knows? It's probably very significant because the shocks are mildly relativistic or relativistic, and so any thermalization, dissipation in the shock layer will send the electrons to high enough energies that they'll be able to resonate with Whistler waves. And once they do that, they can then happily diffuse around and take off in the Fermi process. The reason I say that is you get electrostatic fields set up. Did you get some sort of mediation between the ion and the electron inertial scales that gives you a minimum Lorentz factor for the electron? And that's really a point down here. What is the gamma min for the electrons? It's not 1. It might be MP over ME. I doubt it'll be that high. It's probably the square root of it, around about 43 times the electron rest mass. Only because of the induced electric fields in the shock layer, because the protons have a different rigidity from the electrons. Is gamma min a fair representation? Well, I have issues about that. That is, gamma min is just a sharp cutoff to the minimum Lorentz factor, and we don't expect that to be a realistic summation from acceleration theory. Expect it to be smeared out, and maybe quasi-thermal distribution. So that's important from the observational standpoint of looking at BATSE data. So as to whether it's a fixed value or whether there's actually a range smeared out.
Of course, for both those questions, pairs can make a tremendous difference.
Right. They do. I should point out that the only known pairs, I mean, there are two known pair simulations, one really in the literature, one not, and they both produce quite a broad, right, for pairs, pure pair simulations, they produce quite a broad range of gamma min that you get natural thermalization. That's not unexpected. Well, there are a host of other issues. I've gone on long enough. Spatial constraints on the maximum energy, we don't expect them to be anything different from what we already know. From, say, supernova remnants, the spatial scale has to be that the mean free path is greater than or equal to the gyro radius, and it has to be less than the radius of the source. In a supernova remnant, you have 1 microgauss as your typical field. Maybe in the Cas A, it'll be much higher, it's a milligauss. Your gyro radius must be less than roughly 10 parsecs, the typical size of a supernova remnant, and that sets you at 10 to the 13 electron volts as your maximum energy. For gamma ray bursts, your spatial scale is considerably smaller. And it doesn't matter. You can compute it in any frame of reference, but whatever you buy in with the Lorentz factors in one frame of reference, you lose through, you can't gain anything. You can do the calculation in the observer's frame and you're fine. And that's the spatial scale we have, roughly, and maybe even smaller. And in order to get ultra-high energy cosmic rays, you have to have a 100 Gauss field. If you're producing them externally, you have to have them in the external shock. If you're producing them internally, your field could be that high, but it may not be, but then you don't have nearly as much space. So, okay, I think I'll close there, really, because I've said enough. So, I've gone over. Yeah, whatever. Thanks.
Well, you have, you know, that actually we could expect to have a mixture of pinch angle diffusion and large scattering, large angle scattering. But is this the ratio between the two processes energy independent, or could expect to have one of these processes more important for lower energies and the other for larger energies? And if there is energy dependence, would you expect to see then a bimodal distribution in the
emission? Yeah, there is an energy dependence, and that is determined by when the particle speed exceeds the Lorentz factor of the flow. At lower, then your kinematic transformations as you go from one frame to the other change materially. And so, whether you deflect particles, you know, very quickly beyond the Lorentz cone, the Lorentz cone is, that I've talked about, is for very high-speed particles, where the Lorentz factor of the particle far exceeds the Lorentz factor of the flow, where you can get all these asymptotic results and get power laws. Below that, you'll get a different situation, and if delta B over B is, even if delta B over B is independent of momentum over a huge range, which it probably won't be, and the diffusion scales have a single formula as a function of momentum. In other words, lambda proportional to p to the alpha, you have one alpha for all momenta, you will still get different structures. You'll have a different mixture of pitch angle diffusion and large angle scattering once you go beyond this critical speed, particle speed, where the Lorentz factor exceeds the fluid flow speed, the fluid flow Lorentz factor.
Then my question is, do you really expect to have a pure power law spectrum?
No, of the diffusion length. The answer is...
In the spectrum you see?
A pure power law, yes.
Or do you expect to find the power law with the given index in the given regime and then change to the other power?
Well, that's what I'm saying, if I can just draw it up here. And that is... that you have your spectrum, and if you're having if you have large angle diffusion, it has this region up to roughly a gamut. If this is T proton, then at gamma T proton, you have this region where you, after that point, you start to have the asymptotic solution. You have a power law. Prior to that, you don't have a power law. Now, even if you have a pure pitch angle diffusion, you don't have an exact power law, because this is the sort of scale of influence. From that and beyond that, with pitch angle diffusion, you don't know anything about this. You don't care whether it's a broad distribution, narrow distribution. So, if you have deviations from this, those deviations will be produce different results. You know, for large angle scattering, you'll get a power law here. You'll get something else. It's not a power law here, but it'll be significantly different from that. More so even than this is different from that. And you can look in those plots I show you. That is all with one proportional to momentum to the alpha. And if you have some critical momentum at which you can change this, which may have physical motivations, and one can do that, you'll then introduce structure. However, that's not that. You can play around with this, and you don't get the results are not very sensitive to it. You know, once you get up to these highest momentum. I think Max and then Chris. Yeah.
So. These asymptotic power laws, how sensitive are they to the strength of scattering?
Not at all.
Not at all?
Yeah. Wait a minute. Define the strength of scattering. Are you talking? Are you talking about delta B over B, or are you talking about?
No, I'm talking about the
number in front here.
The how many general radii you go before you scatter.
Right, they're independent of that. I mean, they in a parallel shock, they're independent of that. The results that I showed you where they were dependent on it for Ostrovsky, Bethmanns and Ostrovsky results, the spectral index is dependent on it because the probability that you sweep out of this Lorentz cone is determined by the kappa perp over kappa parallel.
Yeah.
And that is, it's not relevant to the parallel shock problem. Now, we chose a parallel shock, put the field along the shock normal, A, because it's easy, but B, because in these ultra-relativistic shocks, talking about a shock obliquity is probably not a material consideration. Because if gamma is really much greater than 1, all you care about is not the field orientation, but deflections from the shock normal. And you can assess all the properties just with a pure plane parallel shock acceleration and not mess it up with. I should say that in the results I showed for the interplanetary shocks, where Keith Ogilvie and I and Don Ellison got together and made a fit to the data, we had a kappa perp over kappa parallel, which is a function of this lambda over Rg. We tuned that in order to get the injection efficiency. The injection efficiency is basically coupled to the anisotropy of the non-relativistic particles at superthermal energies. And the analogous behavior of that in relativistic shocks is the anisotropy couples to the spectral index in relativistic shocks. So the same type of kinematic effects are appearing in both scenarios. But in the non-relativistic shocks, it gives you the normalization of the power law, of the canonical power law. In a relativistic shock, it gives you the slope of a non-canonical power law. Chris?
Okay, well,
maybe you can, yeah, we've, I mean, yeah.
So great, thank you.
You're welcome.